WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
Yes. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Ron Green Jr. wrote his first sports story 40 years ago and saw it published in the pages of the Charlotte News. That eventually led to a 22-year career at the Charlotte Observer. The Charlotte News is gone, and now so is Ron Green Jr., at least from the pages of the Observer. After decades of writing about sports, especially about golf, Ron decided the time had come to do something different. Well, a little different, by moving from newspapers to the web. This month, he launched the next chapter of his sports writing career by moving to globalgolfpost.com. It is the first designed-for-digital weekly golf news publication in the world. It has a subscription service of almost 600,000 on its way to a million. And amazingly enough, it's free. Ron Green Jr. is here to talk about sports, writing about sports, golf, writing about golf, newspapers, writing for newspapers, and now the brave new world of digital publishing and writing for the digital world. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Nice to be back.
I should say welcome back, yes. So you've gone green. In other words, literally, your name and your modus operandi, because you're not going to be in print anymore. Why the move? Why now?
It just seemed like a good time. It's not something I was out sort of chasing, but they came to me, and this is a publication that's been growing. It's in its fourth full year. It's gotten bigger and been able to do more things. I believe they finally saw, you know, financially it began to look more appealing for them, and they wanted a full-time senior-type writer to cover the PGA Tour. They have a guy who does travel, goes to all these exotic places around the world, and then tests all the new equipment, which is really the cool job. But they want somebody to cover the PGA Tour. I will be at about 20 events this year, and then to write a weekly column about whatever's going on or whatever sort of strikes my fancy there. And it's very flattering. I had done some freelance work for them in the past. They have a nice stable of golf writers around the world. John Hopkins, who's worked for the Times of London for years, Art Spanner, very famous name in our business, guys like that who have been working for him. And when they ask, it just seemed like the right time. Golf is what I like to write about the most. I like doing the other stuff too. But you know, golf is sort of a niche product in a lot of ways for newspapers, and we're fortunate here with the golf atmosphere, environment we live in. But it just felt like the right thing at the right time. It's funny. My wife changed jobs, created her own business last summer, and then this came along. So we are right in the middle of a lot of changes right now, but it's been very fun so far.
Who are the people behind this, globalgolfpost.com?
The publisher's a man named Jim Nugent down in Florida. Worked in the golf magazine business through the years. Golf Week, which is one of the two big, has been one of the two big print publications, weekly magazines. Brian Hewitt is the editor, worked in Chicago at a newspaper, worked for Golf Week as a writer down there, and was on the Golf Channel for a long time. Mike Perkey, who used to work years ago at the Observer here, covered golf and then went to Golf Magazine. Those are sort of the main people I work with, and they've sort of taken this vision that Jim Nugent came up with and taken it and built it, and you know, it's continuing to grow and to develop. We've sort of added a daily blog feature where we update things because it is a weekly magazine and it comes in your email box magically sometime before I tend to get up on Monday mornings, and there it is for 40 or 50 pages. But to keep things fresh during the week, we'll expand on that as we go forward. I think there's some video ideas for down the road, but it's a new world for me because I'm of the generation, I still like to pick up a magazine or a newspaper.
Well, that was my next question, because golf, it seems to me, appeals a lot to older people. A lot of retirees play golf. A lot of middle-aged people who are business executives obviously play golf, and they like paper. They're not of the generation yet that they will be. The next generation will be accustomed to reading off of phones and iPads and Nooks and Kindles and things like that, but they like paper. So how do you know how people who consume this are reading it, on what kind of a device they're reading it on. Are they reading it on a laptop? Are they reading it on a desktop? Are they reading it on their iPad? How are they reading it?
I'm sure the people in charge know that, and I probably heard it when I was at a retreat in December. I think it's a lot of – I think iPads are really changing a lot of things to the point my mother, who has bought everything internet-related through her life, when I told her I was doing this, she said, well, I won't be able to read you now. I'm like, well – we got her an iPad for Christmas, so now she can look and read and maybe do emails and all that. So, yeah, I think there's a portion of the population that's just sort of reluctant to change. And, I mean, I've worked at the paper for all these years, and I could look at it on the computer, but I want to sit there in the morning with my cup of coffee and read it. And I don't think that's going to go away. I think that's going to stay in some form or fashion for a long time. But, you know, it's like – Jerry Richardson, one day we ran into him at lunch, said, you know, the three things my grandkids don't need are landlines, newspapers, and watches. Because
that's right.
Everything is on their cell phone. And right. I think we're going to that. And I think they sort of saw this as sort of catching the wave of the future. And somebody was going to do it, so they did it. And so far, it's been successful.
You wrote a valedictory column when you – I guess you've already left the paper. They're turning off your email today.
That's
right?
What they told me. So, yeah, I said all those wrestling releases from Appalachian State, I won't know how the wrestling team is doing.
So you wrote a farewell column, as did Tommy Tomlinson and other people who have been at the paper for a long time. Tommy moved on to a similar kind of a venture. Mm-hmm. And you talked about in that column about the character of the newsroom, the newspaper newsroom, and how it's changed when you first arrived here. And you said, gone are the clacking typewriters and the clattery teletypes. And I remember that in radio newsrooms. We used to put the teletype room in a little room by itself with doors you could close because it was deafening, all these teletypes going off.
Ding, 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 ding.
But now
ding.
It's completely silent because we don't have teletypes. We have nothing. It just all comes in on the computer like this. It's very quiet. But soon, newspapers themselves may be gone, and great writers and popular writers leave. Do you worry that when people like you and Tommy leave great newspapers like The Observer, and it is one of the good papers in the country, that you're hastening its demise?
Well, I don't want to flatter myself that much, but I know what you mean. I think, yeah, there's a shift toward these new sort of enterprises, new ways of writing and everything. I think it's been a problem or a challenge that newspapers have faced for a long time. And, I mean, I've been in it. I remember years ago when people said, well, the internet's going to change all this and do away with newspapers, and thinking, well, that's not going to happen. Well, we're closer to it now. I think newspapers are adapting. I think what The Observer has done with his website is really good. I think, and maybe it's because of my tie there, but when I flip on the computer, that's where it opens up, and I can keep track of what's going on, and then you can pick and choose how much you want to read each time. But yeah, I think newspapers are it's. I don't know how many young people think about their career in a newspaper.
Right.
I think there are some who do that, and I think hopefully it will continue. But the generation I have been part of. So many of the guys who were sort of the ones I looked up to, especially in the Carolinas, you know, another one, Carlton Tudor, the sports columnist in Raleigh, just his retirement was announced this week at the 1st of March. I mean, he was one of the guys, I mean, for 30 years, he was part of it. And you knew he was one of the guys everybody knew in the business. Lennox Rawlings in Winston-Salem, a great writer, retired in December. And
well, we had your father on this program, and we've had you on this program before, and we've had Tommy on the program many times. We've talked a lot about writing and writing for newspapers and the kinds of writing that people like you, columnists, do. Are there young people coming up in the newspaper business who are following in your footsteps as you followed in your father's? Are there people writing the kinds of things you wrote the way you wrote them, or is that a thing of the past? All we want is the X's and O's now.
Well, I'm one of those who the stuff I read tends to be less the X's and O's and more what the columnist. I want it filtered through somebody. You sort of develop a relationship with a columnist of the newspaper, and sort of you don't always have to agree with them, but you read through them. I think we knew the scores of games 30 years ago before we got up in the morning, usually if we watched the late news. And now I think, you know, where newspapers have struggled is to there's less space in newspapers to do the big storytelling things. When you do it.
Why? Because there's less pages?
Fewer pages.
Because there's not as many ads, and therefore they can't justify the print?
I think it's more an economic issue, sure, which then leads to staff issues and things like that. I think there's still room to read it. I think we all have shorter reading spans. Remember, Sports Illustrated used to always have in the back of its magazine this mini book that you would take 2 days to read on the weekend, and they don't do that anymore. Their long stories are shorter now, if that makes sense. And I love reading the columnists. Those are the best parts of newspapers to me.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I take the New York Times every day, and it would be a miracle. I think it's happened 7 times in the 15 years I've taken the New York Times that I've read all of the New York Times Sunday magazine. I've never read the entire Sunday Times in my life. It can't be done. And people used to laugh at USA Today because the articles are so short and truncated and brief. Well, I get it on my phone now, and I think they're too long.
I have
to scroll more than twice.
It's the way we are. I mean, like we were just talking, if you have to wait 10 seconds on your computer for something, you're just irritated. Just think if you had to wait on telecopiers, they used to call them before they called them fax machines.
That's right. So you wrote in your farewell column that you worked with great people, had good times, good place to work, great newspaper, blah, blah, blah. And you said that you love newspapers, but you don't like the way the business is heading. What does that mean? Is that what we just talked about, or is there something more to it?
I just think it's the way it's going away or diminishing. I don't think newspapers can do the things they used to do. I've talked to some colleagues, guys who've been in the business a long time, and there were still fun parts to doing what we were doing in the newspaper business. And I'm doing the same thing at Global Golf Post, but there were fewer of them. I mean, used to be we would go more places and do more things and have freer rein to just go take some time and go write this or write a bigger story, go to more big events, and just the economics and everything. I go in media rooms now, and there's so many fewer people than there used to be.
Yeah.
And I don't know. And maybe there's just more sports. I don't know. I may have said it on this show before, but it's almost a Yogi Berraism. There's so much on now, I don't watch much of it at all because it's just – there's always games on it.
It's not special.
It's not special. It's lost some.
It's not appointment watching, viewing, attendance, whatever.
No, it's not like it used to be. And maybe that's my generation. I don't know. I mean, there's still big things. We all stopped to watch the Super Bowl and things like that. I was in the Phoenix airport, and they actually held my plane boarding the last 5 minutes because to watch the last four plays or whatever when San Francisco was trying to score, and they had TVs all around where we were in the terminal, and even the person who was going to board the plane, they just stood and watched. As soon as they didn't score, all right, we're ready to begin boarding.
You talked a little bit about people's attention spans and the tolerance they have with reading long articles. So when you're writing for this new publication, globalgolfpost.com, are your articles shorter than they would have been, say, 10 years ago in The Observer, or do you have the leisure or the ability to write long because you've got infinite space in these publications?
I have the leisure to write as long as it doesn't go past 800 words. the column is about 800, 850 words, which is longer than, like my friend Ken Berger, who's great local sports and then local columnist in Charleston, sort of a legend down there. His columns are only 450 words, which, I mean, that was, I mean, hardly even clearing your throat for some of us. But
yeah.
So 800 words is a nice length. I think anything longer, you start stretching it a little bit. You start going to more pages. It's or screens. I'm learning to say screens in this new thing. And then we do things with notes. I think there's a lot of ways to take things in. The way we do it, you can sort of link to notes in this thing, and you can read the first part of it, and if you're interested, you can click here and go on, and if you want to commit that much time to it.
Yeah, that's something else to get used to, I would imagine.
Yes.
Yeah. Ron Green Jr., our guest, former sports writer with the Charlotte Observer and now senior writer for GlobalGolfPost.com. We'll talk more about that venture and about golf and about writing about golf and more as we go on. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Beckner Museum of Modern Arts, The Game of Modern Love, celebrating the enduring partnerships of artistic twosomes with cocktails, hors d'oeuvres, live music, and more. February 15th at 7. Details and tickets at Beckler.org. The civil rights era that was transformative for so many baby boomers and those of other generations is quickly fading into history, and the challenge of keeping that turbulent period and the changes it wrought interesting and alive for younger people is being taken up now by Taylor Branch. He is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of a trilogy of books about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He joined us several years ago when that trilogy was completed, and he will rejoin us tomorrow to share the process of framing that era, something he's involved in right now, framing that era for the 21st century student. That's tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the only Republican in President Obama's cabinet is stepping down. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood reflects on efforts to improve safety and consumer rights in the administration's first term.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks, here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Ron Green Jr., our guest. Sounds strange when I say this. Former sports columnist for the Charlotte Observer and now senior writer for a new venture for him, but it's been in existence for several years now, something called GlobalGolfPost.com. It is an internet magazine that comes in your email box. This is a new and I take a couple of magazines that come in on my computer and my iPad and my iPhone. I don't think I read them on the iPhone. It's just too much trouble. I don't have an iPhone. Excuse me, on my Android phone. It's a new way of bringing information to people, and it took a while to get used to it for me, but I like it better than the pages because the only thing I don't like about it is I can't dog ear the pages. And I can't tear them out and save them when I want to put them in a file. That's the only thing I don't like about them.
I'm sure there's somebody who could tell you
how to do that.
Computer savvy person could tell you how to do that.
11-year-old could tell me how to do that.
Well, yeah, we have a 13-year-old daughter who we call the IT director for my wife's company. We say something, we can't figure something out. Molly, how does this work? Oh, there it is. It's just, I mean, they were born with a gene we weren't born with.
Well, that's right. That's why I could hook up the stereo at home. My father couldn't do it.
That's exactly right.
Speaking of fathers and sons, not everybody shares their father's interests or their father's career, but you do with Ron Green Sr. He also seems to have been a great influence on you, and not all men can say that about their dads. They spend a lot of time rebelling against them or doing something other than what dad did or doing it the opposite way. Why was he such an influence on you, do you think?
Well, I mean, just because of who he is and the way he went about it. And, you know, I as a kid, once I figured out what I had to do to become an orthopedic surgeon and how I wasn't quite prepared for that path, I wanted to be a sports writer. And I remember hearing the stories of him talking about, you know, to me, these bigger-than-life people he was around. Now, a lot of it was just being around AA baseball players at the old Griffith Park here, and when he used to do the public address announcing during the games and then write about them, and I'd go sit in a press box on summer nights. But hearing, you know, about the Masters and, you know, in the glory days of ACC football, and I don't know if there have been glory days of ACC football, but ACC basketball, you know, and hearing about being around Dean Smith, hearing stories about Everett Case and all those guys, you know, it was very glamorous. And the newspaper was a particularly glamorous thing then. And, you know, I remember we would, on Saturdays, we would pile in the car, and if he was going to cover a Duke-Virginia football game, we'd go sit in the stands and watch it and then ride back home. And I just, you know, I was around him and hearing his stories and seeing what he did and reading it. And I remember trying to write little stories like that when I was a kid. And he took me in the newsroom on some Saturdays in the summer when I was young. And, you know, I liked it and I fell into it. And part of what's been great about sports writing, and I think most of us who've been in it a long time will tell you, is as much as the games is the media rooms and the guys, there was a fraternity of people you tended to see over and over at games. Mm-hmm. And you're all trying to basically write the same thing, do your own, put your own spin on it. But I think there's a great camaraderie to that, and the stories you told, and whether it was in a bar after the game or sitting around the media room before the game, or just in that crush when, you know, Dean Smith's been thrown out of the national semifinals game, and we're all thinking, well, wait a minute, this is too big to write. What do we do? And we're all running around there. That's been a great part of it. I've gotten to know so many people who became friends and stayed friends through it. And I think when guys leave, I think that's what they miss as much as the games. I mean, we've seen a lot of games.
Yeah.
But I think you miss the people. And that's what, in covering events, sporting events, people wonder, do you pull for this team or that team? Well, if you're lucky and you get to know the people, you kind of pull for the people. And, you get accused, or I was accused. Yes, I went to North Carolina, but my wife will tell you I'm a huge fan of Duke basketball. I love North Carolina basketball. I love NC State basketball, all those things, because that's what I grew up with, and, David Thompson and things like that. And when you get to be around the people and you realize once they take the shirt off, I mean, they're just guys and people that you really like that. And, Dick Sheridan at NC State was one of my favorite people to get to know and cover, and through the years, Roy Williams and all that. And you kind of don't see the teams as much as I have. There was a time when I couldn't go to school as a kid if North Carolina basketball lost. I mean, I would just, I can't go to school today. It's so upsetting. And now it's like, oh, did they play last night? Really?
Well, you're a little older now. You're not
that's
quite
true.
Attached to it. But in your last column for the paper, you talked about getting to hang around a lot of these people over the course of your career, and even before your career because of your dad, going with him to things. But you talked about, I think, meeting Mike Krzyzewski when nobody knew who he was. About talking to Tiger Woods in the locker room about things that had nothing to do with golf.
Yeah.
Dale Earnhardt Sr., riding around with him, riding around in Junior Johnson's personal car, what a careful driver he was on the road.
Very careful.
You described Jake DeLome's face moments after they lost the 2004 Super Bowl. How has seeing and being with people like this in situations off the field shaped you and how you view athletes and professional sports?
Well, I think you probably don't get as much personal time with them as you'd like. Not that you want to be best buddies with them, but if you're lucky, you get to be around them in sort of unguarded moments. And you see a little bit, I don't know if it's behind the curtain, but you get to see a little bit of what people are like. I've been fortunate to be around Phil Mickelson a good bit. And he's a guy who I was like a lot of people in the business who didn't sort of buy the whole Phil Mickelson package when he came out, the smile, all this, and okay, he's just too good to be true, and it just was a little much. But over the years, I can't think of anybody in golf particularly who has won the media over like Phil did, because, well, if it was an act, well, it's going on 25 years now, and it's a pretty good act, and it's not an act. I think he is he's a different guy, but he is, he'll give you some, you can see behind the scenes a little bit. I wrote something one time that he particularly liked that mattered, and out of the blue, he called me just to thank me, which nobody would ever do. It was something about his wife I'd written when she got sick, and it was very flattering that he would do that. And most guys, wouldn't even acknowledge when you've written just some glowing piece about him. They're not going to tell you that, but, it's nice when you get to see people. Ron Rivera is a guy here who everybody sees him on the sidelines and, naturally they complain about they did this or they didn't do that and all that stuff. But what a great guy and great person. And
why?
Just, I think his upbringing, his personality, what the sort of the moral code he lives by. I just trust what he says. I mean, we're yet to be determined how great a football coach he is. I think he's going to be – he's a good one. And he tries to do the right thing, and he doesn't try to mislead you when – there are inevitably times when you're trying to get information out of a coach that he's not going to tell you. And you could tell it almost – he's almost uncomfortable not telling you. He'll just say, look, I just can't tell you. I'm not going to lie to you, but just understand, I can't tell you right now. Almost apologetic, and I think he really tries to do it right. Tries to treat everybody the way he'd like to be treated, and you don't always run across people like that.
You're a Charlotte native. You were born here, grew up here, went away to college after UNC Charlotte. You went to Chapel Hill, and then you went and wrote, I think, for newspapers in the Greenville, South Carolina area, and finally came back, but first to the Raleigh Bureau of the Observer, and then gradually back here. So you've been here a long time. And you talked about Griffith Park, and I know you covered things and you went with your dad to places like the Bojangles Coliseum when it was the Charlotte Coliseum before the other Charlotte
Coliseum. I still call it the Charlotte Coliseum, yeah.
Talk about that time, because now we have an NFL team. We're on our second NBA team. We have a minor league baseball team moving back into the
– Finally.
Finally, in confines of the city. But that's all we had back then. We had a minor league baseball team who played at Griffith Park, which is now where – Lowe's is on South Boulevard or near that area. What was it like? We didn't have major league sports here. We didn't have big arenas that were millions, $100 million.
They felt big to me as a kid growing up around here and going to see, you know, occasionally a major league team would come in and play an exhibition early in the season. And so you sort of get to see the big guys. But, you know, I mean, people cared about the Hornets, or that's my memory, and a lot of great players. I mean, I remember
the Hornets basketball team. Or the
I'm
Hornets
sorry, the Hornets, team? The original baseball Hornets.
Yeah, okay.
We have a whole list of Hornets through
yes,
the years.
Do.
And but don't forget, championship wrestling was really big back then. And I used to feel they wouldn't wrestle in the Bojangles Arena all the time, but when they did put 11,000 people in there and fill that place to the rafters, because I used to always go with my grandfather. And it would get so smoky. I remember sitting in there. I couldn't see the top of the other side of the building. And,
wow.
But that was big time sports here.
Wrestling used to take place in what is now the news studio at WBTV.
Really?
Yeah. You didn't know this?
Oh, I do remember that. That's right.
Because ringing, if you go up above the lights in the news studio, there are windows along the walls in the studio. And that's because people used to sit up in box seats, essentially, and look down onto the studio floor and watch wrestling going on television on WBTV.
I don't think people realize how big a deal it was around here for a long time. It was very – and the Checkers used to play in Bojangles Arena. As a kid, we would go – and they would fill that place up a lot, especially when they played the hated Greensboro Generals. I can still remember that you'd get all fired up because the Generals were coming to town in their green and yellow uniforms, and that would be a big deal. And I still look at the football stadium every time I go in there and wonder how this all came to be.
Yeah, because it sounds so innocent, but it sounds so – and maybe it's because I lived through that same time period. I wasn't here, but I remember things being small, and we didn't know they were small.
No.
They were just what they were.
Yeah, well, everything, it's all gotten so unnecessarily big in so many ways right now. There's so much to everything.
I think the Super Bowl halftime show this year is a good example of that.
Yeah, I didn't get to see it. I was just getting checked into the airport when that happened. But
it was big.
It was
spectacle.
The Super Bowl, you know, they revel in bigness out there. I think there was a quaintness to the way things were around here. And you know, I miss the old – I don't go in Bojangles Arena much, but, I mean, I worked as an usher there as a kid, and I can remember seeing everybody from the Carpenters to, you know, Glenn Campbell and Loretta Lynn and those shows there. I got to see the Monkees show there in whatever, 67.
I was going to bring that up. I'm told that you saw the Monkees' Jimi Hendrix show at the Bojangles Arena, and tell me that they weren't on the same bill.
They were on the same bill. Jimi Hendrix opened
– For the Monkees?
There, he did like four or five shows with them, and that happened to be one. And the two things I remember about it was my mom taking us to the show there, and we're all fired up. And I'm still a Monkees fan. And we used to get to go in this press store, and we went around behind the stage door. And I remember her telling me, now, you know they're going to look different than they look on TV. Now, I don't know why they were going to look different than they'd look on TV, but about that time, this limousine pulls up to the stage doors there, and, I mean, we're 15 feet away, and out comes Jimi Hendrix and his band, and I'm like, and thinking, wow, they really look different. The Monkees really look different than I thought, not knowing Jimi Hendrix was there. And I remember him playing, and after a while getting frustrated because everybody's screaming, wanting to hear Last Train to Clarksville, and throwing his guitar down. I remember hearing it boom and walking off stage. And it was in one of the books one of the Monkees did, or a book about them, that they had four or five shows. It just so happened one of them was here, and a friend of mine still has the ticket.
Wow.
Yeah.
That just seems odd to the max.
It was, well, that's, yeah, when you look back, and I thought, it's like putting, saw Jimi Hendrix.
It's like putting the Carpenters with Patti Smith to me.
It makes no sense at all.
You know, you wrote your first story in the Charlotte News. As a kid, your father just tossed us, he was the sports editor of the Charlotte News, And he just tossed off an opportunity for you to write something. I suppose if it wasn't good, he wouldn't have printed it, but he did print it. And that was kind of the kickoff, right?
Yeah, I'm sure what I wrote in those little three paragraphs about a small dirt track race Friday night or whatever, probably what I wrote and what got in the paper were slightly different, but slightly edited. But, yeah, that was sort of it. And I remember – so I'd do that a little bit, and then – I would work for the high school newspaper and the student newspaper at UNC Charlotte, and then would cover high school football games for the Observer on Friday nights when I could. I remember the first one was a Myers Park game.
But given the level that your father was at the paper at the time, and your dreams of being, I guess they were dreams of being a sports writer like your father, but maybe not like your father, maybe just to be a sports writer. But you all have to, in the back of your mind, it would seem to me that you're doing something that Dad is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And if I do it, do I need to reach that level, match up to that level? Does he have to approve? Are people going to compare me to him when I get to a certain degree and they're actually paying attention to what I'm writing? Did that ever occur to you?
Well, yeah. You know, I heard many times, well, you just got this because of your dad. Sure, I'm sure the fact that him being in the business, it didn't hurt. But what it would come down to ultimately is when I had to sit down after a game or whatever and write that story, well, he wasn't there to write it, so I had to write it.
Right.
And you learn to do it as you go through it. There's nothing like, especially in newspapers, colleges can teach you certain things, but you just learn it when you're out there and you have to go into a locker room and get a quote from a guy who just gave up the winning touchdown or something like that. We talked more about writing, and his advice was, and especially as a columnist, to sort of try to show people, take people where they can't go, and let your personality shine through. He was, a lot of columnists, especially today, make their living just on ripping and shredding and being controversial, which in a lot of ways, that's easy to do. It's easy to go rip something every other day. He didn't do that a lot, but when he decided to make a point, he made a point, and I think it sort of rang louder a little bit because it wasn't something bashing somebody all the time. You know, when Dean Smith ruined a perfectly great ACC championship game against Virginia and Ralph Sampson years ago and slowed it down, turned this fast-paced, beautiful game into a 47-45 game that led to the shot clock adoption. I remember my dad writing a column about, you know, that you just ruined it. That's not the way to play basketball. And I think Coach Smith took exception to that, but you know, obviously the game changed a little bit. But you know, to this day, I still like for him to read what I write and get his feedback on things, and especially unsolicited. You know, sometimes like, hey, read this. What do you think? And I still ask him about ideas, and you know, we keep him writing some for the Observer. I think he's getting ready to go back to his 59th Masters here in April.
Maybe he's taking over for you.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
Did he early in your career, did he encourage you to pursue this? Did he discourage you? Did he try to warn you away from it? Did he tell you about all the pitfalls that you might run into along the way? Because not everybody can be successful at anything. Just because Dad was successful doesn't mean you're going to be successful.
Right. Well, some of that. I mean, he never pushed me to do it at all, never discouraged me, left it to me to decide. And when I would ask him or we'd talk about it, you know, he would give me advice and point me in this direction or make this suggestion or that. When I went to – I think it was when I went to North Carolina, went to Chapel Hill, he wrote a column about me going away to be a sports writer and basically told what it was like.
Right.
It's obviously changed a lot now. I tell him now that you got out at the right time. But he's been huge.
See, that's why I asked the question, because today people in broadcasting would say, yeah, if I were 20, I wouldn't do this. And you say you got out at the right time. See, now, your dad didn't say that. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at the UNC Center for Heart and Vascular Care, providing comprehensive treatments for aortic diseases. Information at uncaortic.com. The only Republican in President Barack Obama's cabinet is stepping down. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood reflects on efforts to improve safety and consumer rights in the administration's first term in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation with Ron Green, hop on the phone. 800-924-9263-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back. When we ask about your favorite programs on WFAE, you rarely, never mention pledge drives. In an attempt to give you more programming and less fundraising, we're encouraging you to pledge your support now to help shorten the spring fundraiser. Every dollar received before the campaign begins will go towards the $550,000 goal, and for every $55,000 raised, we'll take a day off the drive. Go to WFAE.org to make your pledge, and you'll be entered to win a trip to the French Riviera. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're sitting here this morning with Ron Green, Jr., former sports columnist for the Charlotte Observer and now writing for GlobalGolfPost.com. It is a weekly Monday morning magazine that appears as if by magic in your email inbox. And it's like, how many pages? Like 50, 60 pages every Monday?
About 50, I think, yeah.
Is that much to write about golf every week?
I think there's a lot of ads in there, which is a good thing.
You say you got your passion for golf from your father, who's certainly a golf fan. What is it about golf?
Well, I will be asking that question
for a lot.
Probably later this afternoon after my second double bogey in three holes or something. I don't know. I understand not everybody gets it, but I think it's writing about it I like because it's hard to write about football teams. You're writing about this big sort of impersonal thing in a lot of ways, and there's a lot of moving pieces. With golf, you're writing about a person and usually their story.
And it's also not as big.
No, it although I just smaller. Came back from the Waste Management Phoenix Open, which is...
The what?
The Phoenix Open, sponsored by Waste Management, which had enough logos out there that if you were in the space shuttle, you could have seen them. But they had 177,000 or thereabouts at the golf tournament on Saturday. It is the biggest... They have a stadium on the 16th holes of par 3 with 15,000 seats, and it looks sort of like I imagine Bristol Motor Speedway looks. And they put these people in there, and the noise doesn't stop when they play. They cheer. The caddies race to the green. I mean, it is everything not golf you could ever imagine, and it's hugely popular there. But golf can be very personal, and you can get close to golfers when you're at a golf tournament. And they're tortured people in a lot of ways, but they work in nice places, and if they play well, they make a lot of money.
Yeah. You know, we were talking about writing for newspapers, but I think this holds true for a lot of different things but when it comes to news reporting. But reporters, ordinary reporters, people who report on developing news stories in newspapers, on television, on radio, are sent to the scene of the story, whether it's a press conference or a murder or something else, and they know nothing. They know little to nothing about what they're reporting on. You guys, sports writers, know about golf and football and baseball. How did that happen? I mean, you're the only experts writing in the paper aside from the weatherman.
Well, I think there's a lot of people who would question that expert part about it and have questioned that. Well, I think if you get to know stuff, like if you're around a football team for the season, you can't help but absorb some stuff and learn sort of what's going on and notice trends or notice what's happening with a particular dynamic. I think there's a repetition almost to it because you're around teams on such a regular basis. I don't know that you're around the city council on a regular basis. You may show up once a week when they have a meeting, but you're not there every day going in the locker room, standing there just chit-chatting with people, hearing them talk to each other or whatever. So there's a closeness that you get there that allows sports writers – especially the really good reporters to develop sources. I've always been or considered myself more of a writer than a reporter. If you need somebody to go dig out the hard to get investigative story, you wouldn't come to me first. There are people who are just masters at that. But I'm more like the nuance, the color, the personality of it.
But I was going to ask you how you blend the X's and O's, the details that people want to know or need to know about, whether it's a golf tournament or a football game or whatever, with the story that you find appealing and with your own personal voice on it. How do you learn to blend all that together into something that is uniquely you?
Well, I think just through practice and doing it, and good editors help and sort of push you. A lot of times on event stories, you don't have a lot of time to rewrite things, but on bigger feature stories, you do. I think now in newspaper or whatever stories you read, whether in Global Golf Post on Monday or whatever, there's less and less play-by-play. We don't need to tell you as much about what happened. You sort of pick the two or three most salient moments of the day or the game or whatever, and you build around that. I can remember sitting in many, many press boxes on Saturday afternoon at a Clemson-Wake Forest football game, and it's 10-3 in the second quarter, and somebody deflects a pass for an incompletion on second down. And I'll hear somebody say, "Who did that?" so they could write it down. I'm like, "Well, you're never going to use it. Please don't put that in your story. It's a meaningless play." But I think you look now more for the bigger thread, the bigger theme to it. And it's amazing how already on a Sunday football game for Monday morning, you're already sort of looking at next week. It's already pushing forward. You almost can't cover that before you're already starting to the next week.
A lot of golf lovers and a lot of amateur players would love to do what you do, travel the country, going to all these major tournaments, meeting with and talking to the players, and just watching the golf games unravel as they go on, or unroll as they go on. And yet it seemed to me that what you do is immensely difficult, because people don't realize when they see something on television how focused it is. When you're in the midst of all of this and you don't have a high-powered lens taking you right to the green, you're just in a sea of people. And this thing is going on all around you, and you've got to find the nugget that turns you on and that's going to make it interesting for the reader. How do you do that in the middle of all of this? You're just in a sea.
Yeah. Well, and golf is tricky because it's not all played right in front of you.
Right.
They're in different groups in different places.
You can't be everywhere at once.
Yeah. I mean, like in San Diego 2 weeks ago, Phil and Tiger are playing the same golf course, but they're separated by a mile, basically.
Yeah.
And if you're trying to decide what you're going to do with each one, you look for themes. It depends if you've got something predetermined. It helps when you go to a golf tournament with Tiger because everything sort of starts right there. He's usually part of the story. Still, I think he won three tournaments last year, and people can talk about, well, they don't care about this or that, but the television ratings in every one on that final day jumped by more than 130%, which tells you something.
Yeah.
They don't care about Tiger, but they're still going to watch him.
Yeah.
I think golf is tricky. Once in a while you get lucky and you get swept up. In Phoenix last week when Phil Mickelson nearly shot 59, which is the great final sort of frontier in golf, and it was – we all went out there to watch, and all the gallery was there. And it's great when you get moments like that that you sort of feel the momentum. You feel what's happening. You all know where it's heading. And then it ended with this sort of bittersweet thing where his putt to shoot 59 went all the way around the hole and came back at him. But golf is – it's different. There's one guy to talk to, or his caddy. You talk to other guys about what happened. But a lot of times at the end of golf tournaments, and especially major tournaments, if you're covering them, you end up watching it on TV just because it's so scattered a little bit.
So you stay in the press room and watch it on television?
Most of the time on
– Why go?
Like on a Sunday, you go out and you walk for 9 holes, 10, 12 holes. But like if you come to the end of the Masters and you've got three groups stacked up one behind the other and they're all in different holes and it's all tied, well, like when Rory McIlroy shot 62 or whatever to win Wells Fargo, I saw him play the last hole because it just happened out of the blue. And by the time you realize, look what's going on here, and got over there, he was almost finished.
More often than not, are you looking for what you're going to write about toward the end of the tournament, or are you trying to chip away at things you don't need to write about because there's so many things you could write about?
Yeah, well, lots of times there's things you can sort of discard. You're looking for a theme there. and especially major championships, because they sort of define careers, define the history of the game. And sometimes it's not about who wins, but about who loses. I mean, we have written about Phil Mickelson losing so much, and then he finally won. I mean, we all go back to when he had the U.S. Open, virtually won, and hit it off a tent and lost it. And I'll never forget standing there right in front of him when he just uttered that "I'm such an idiot" line. And you just thought, well, yeah, but you just couldn't help feeling for the guy.
Yeah.
And I think golf especially gives you those stories both ways, whether guys do something dramatically good or dramatically bad.
You've covered over 30 Masters tournaments in your career, along with 50 other major championships. Aside from being the first official tournament of the year each year, what makes the Masters so special to people?
It's all the things it is. It's remarkable when you walk in that place. If you've ever been, it sits right off what looks like sort of Independence Boulevard almost, and mm-hmm. suddenly in fact, I had a guy, one of the players last week was telling a story that he and his college team were in Augusta one year, and they drove by there and just wanted to see the gate, and they thought they were on the wrong road. Like, well, this can't be where it is. And then they stopped, and yeah, this is it. There's this bamboo grows around it so you can't see in, but it's like another world. And it's like, if you could do everything to sort of make it as close to perfect as you could. I mean, literally challenge anybody to find me a weed down there during a golf tournament. It's elegant. It's springtime. It's the time. It's the place. It's this great theater. It's the great history. It's the $1.50 pimento cheese sandwiches that everybody eats. And, you know, it's amazing you can go eat lunch and get a drink and a sandwich and potato chips for less than $5. I mean, it's just... Are you
listening, Jerry Richardson?
We all look, and the fact that they do not allow cell phones, so that, I mean.
Really?
I mean, they don't allow cell phones. We can take them into the media center, but you can't take them out of the media center. I mean, you can't take them out.
What, do they confiscate off them on the way in?
Yeah, well, yes, and they will tell you, do not bring them in. And so it's amazing.
Wow.
People talk to each other, you know, because they're not standing there constantly flipping yeah. through their texts and their emails, and even up under the tree behind the clubhouse. There's this great giant tree, and if you're lucky, you have access to the media and the players and the important people in golf beyond the media are up there. And so they stand there, and they can't be doing business or pretending to pick up the phone as football players would always do when we'd go to approach them somewhere and they'd suddenly grab their phone and pretend to be talking to somebody. You stand up there and talk, and they have there are no electric scoreboards at Augusta. They have wooden handheld.
How have they gotten away with this?
Because it's the Masters.
Because it's the Masters.
And everybody, there's an 8-month buildup from the last major championship, and it comes at the perfect time, and it's just, there's a feeling to it. It's going to be interesting down there this year to see Condoleezza Rice and Darla Moore in their green jackets.
Yeah, how about that? Is the earth going to part? Are waves going to roll over the course? I mean, what's going to happen?
No, but I'm sure they will. I'm sure they will ask them to make themselves, visible out there at certain times, and I'm sure they'll be very cordial. I don't know that they'll be doing any interviews, but they will be very cordial as everyone there is, and. It's just the history of the place and the beauty of it. When you catch it right and the azaleas are in bloom, I mean, the 13th hole has something like 1,600 azaleas planted around there. And you just – I'll go down there on Wednesday afternoon when they close the golf course and everybody goes over to the par 3 and just walk and just – it's a park.
Well, hopefully the azaleas are not blooming right now.
Let's hope they're not.
Yeah. Put the Wells Fargo into some sort of context.
It's one of the best events on the PGA Tour. It's not a major championship, but it's in sort of the next level. They have the guys there, Johnny Harris, Mac Everett, Kim Huffman, the people who run it, Kendall Alley at Wells Fargo. They know what they want. They know how to do it right, mm-hmm. and they have been willing to make the investment to make it right. They don't have too many people out there. They have enough. They understate it. You don't see just – garish displays everywhere. You don't see, like at the tournament in Torrey Pines the other day, Ricky Fowler wears these big flat-billed orange hats, and there's a giant inflatable 15-foot-high Ricky Fowler orange hat right there. I thought, you're not going to see that at the Wells Fargo Championship. The players like the golf course. They like the treatment. There's a There's a classy element to it. It's just, you know, it has an expensive feel to it, and it's the kind of place, and again, you hit it at the right place at the right time. It's the first week in May in Charlotte. It's a great time to be outside. Mm-hmm. It's in the right part of Charlotte, and it's one of those places where people want to be, and they want to be seen. And, you know, part of going to golf tournaments is not to watch the golf, but to go be in your corporate tent or walk around and chit-chat and have your cocktails, and it's not a bad place to do it.
Yeah. Dennis emails, I've been a Global Golf Post subscriber for over a year. This is the new publication that, not new, it's about 4 years old, that Ron Green is becoming senior writer at. And Ron and his dad have an old golf date that hasn't been kept yet. But as I write on my iPad, I'm working at the Mooresville Municipal Golf Course and like to hear Ron's comments regarding the future of the game, munis and slow play.
Yeah, golf has a few issues right now, slow play being one of the biggest ones. You hear people, golf participation has dropped off. And people say it's too expensive, which it probably is, and it's too slow, which it definitely is. And I think the United States Golf Association came out last week saying they're going to try to address slow play. Well,
what does that mean for the people?
That means you should be able to go out and play 18 holes at your local club in 3.5 hours.
And why can't you?
Well, golf carts and building courses that spread out through neighborhoods and things like that, and keeping carts on paths. But we take our cues from the PGA Tour. We watch them. When they had the fog delay rain issue at Torrey Pines a couple weeks ago, they had to finish on a Monday. Tiger Woods and his group had 11 holes to play. It took them 3 hours and 51 minutes to play those 11 holes, which is what it will take most people to play 18 holes. They need to fix that. One of the players said he played 2 holes, caught a plane to San Diego from San Diego to Phoenix, got home, and watched the end on TV. That's how slow it was.
Ron Green Jr. now writing about golf for globalgolfpost.com. That's where you go to sign up for the publication, which will arrive in your email inbox every Monday morning. And it is free.
It is.
So you're working for nothing.
That's the nature of the business.
Good luck. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you very much.